Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Perry Link, who holds the Chancellor's Chair for Innovative Teaching Across Disciplines at the University of California, Riverside, where he's also a Professor of Comparative Literature and Foreign Languages. He is one of the world's foremost experts on Chinese... He is one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, politics, and people, and has translated many Chinese stories, writings, and poems into English. In the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform student protests of June 1989. In 1996, the Chinese government blacklisted Perry Link. Welcome to Background Briefing, Perry Link.
My pleasure.
And today, the Chinese Vice President Xi Jinping has arrived in Washington, and he is the presumptive heir. So everybody's trying to get a feeling for him. First of all, what does it matter, Perry Link? Who's in charge of China? Is it possible that a personality could suddenly appear who could change the country, like say Gorbachev did the Soviet Union?
It's possible, I suppose, but not likely. And if it's possible, it's not because there's any way to tell in advance. In order to rise in the Communist Party of China, you have to learn to play your cards very close to your chest, even towards people very close to you, let alone to the outside world. So it's more or less like reading tea leaves to try to guess what's in the mind of Xi Jinping. And from all of the tea leaf reading I've seen, I don't see any grounds at all for expecting him to make any sharp turns.
Well, we know, at least from press reports, that much of what the Obama White House have said they've said or said they want to say has to do with human rights, and that's a perennial kind of source of friction between the U.S. and China. And there have been some recent Chinese brutality in Tibet. Not that China's treatment of Tibetans hasn't always been pretty brutal. But there's also the most recent source of friction, Perry Link, would be the Russian and Chinese veto of the UN Security Council's attempt to stop the Assad regime from killing its people in Syria.
Yes, yes. Well, the Obama White House has done a little bit better in the last 2 years in raising these issues, both in public and in private, than they had before, and better than the Bush administration before them. So I am guardedly optimistic that Xi Jinping will get an earload about human rights and about vetoing the resolution on Syria. Another aspect of the Syria situation, which I think serious people in China certainly observe and bemoan, is that this is a tremendous loss of face for China in the Arab world and around the world. The New York Times had a very good article about how people in Libya and Egypt are throwing eggs at Chinese embassies and so on for having done that.
Well, that's a bit odd, though, that China has been cultivating Saudi Arabia.
Yes, well, but China, you see, is many things, and what the government and its financial interests are doing can be quite different from what other sorts of Chinese people think and what people in Arab countries on the ground think. So I'm not sure that they really have their act together when they make a veto of a resolution on Syria.
So, Perry Link, what's your sense of the Obama administration's statement in terms of a strategic shift to Asia away from Europe? And accompanying that was the announcement that 2,500 Marines are going to be deployed to Darwin in Australia, as though 2,500 Marines are going to somehow check the growing power of China in Asia.
Well, on the whole, I think that that's a correct shift. I mean, if you look at the world today, if there's going to be trouble spots and a rising power that is unpredictable, it is in Asia, not in Europe. So on the whole, I think that was a fairly good move. And actually, I think the way they did it was fairly good, too. That is, to put the troops in Australia and to announce that we're having this Pacific shift, but at the same time trying to make it clear that this is not meant to provoke the Chinese leadership and that it's just a low-key thing for now.
Well, what is, though, likely to make China dangerous or confrontational in the coming decades? Most of what we've heard from our end in terms of China, the next superpower and its quest for a blue water navy and all that stuff. I mean, if you go back to the Bush administration, there was some very, very reckless behavior going on from Rumsfeld and Cheney and company and the neoconservatives trying to get the Taiwanese to cause trouble as though they wanted a new arms race with China. And fortunately, George W. Bush's uncle, Prescott, who's got business interests in China, was able to prevail. There's always been this kind of to and fro in American policy from the business community wanting more engagement and the military community wanting to gin up China as the next great threat.
I spend most of my time studying China, not the U.S., and all of what you said about U.S. politics rings true to me, but I am more comfortable addressing this from the Chinese side. There's several possible ways that trouble could get started. One is just over resources, keeping sea lanes open and keeping access to raw materials in Latin America and Africa and so on. And then there are these regional jealousies that are pretty long-standing in the South China Sea among Vietnam and the Philippines and China. And China's been, when I say China here, I mean the government, I mean the policymakers. I don't think there's a lot of popular support behind this, but the government is being more assertive and aggressive there, and this creates a bit of friction with Taiwan as well. Another problem that could arise has to do with Chinese nationalism. When the Chinese Communist Party completely lost its domestic credibility after the Tiananmen massacre for a while, one of the main sources they turned to recoup their credibility is nationalism, and they've stoked it through the Olympics and Rising China Image and so on. And this feeds, especially on the Chinese internet, among young people, a kind of ultra-nationalism that can even go farther than the party leaders would want, and it can sort of get out of hand. And that kind of unpredictable nationalist impulse, I think, could, in the wrong hands. And here again, the Chinese military, like the top leadership, is a considerable black box. It's very hard to read what people at the top in the military might want to do. But I don't see any big invasion plans coming out of China to take over the world or anything like that. But in a regional sense, to give Taiwan its comeuppance or to go get Vietnam for being uppity, I think that's a real danger. And this super nationalism that's behind it could be the fuel that makes it happen.
Again, I'm speaking.
By the way, that's why the Southeast Asian countries are more willing in recent months to cooperate with Washington, not because they're in love with Washington per se, but because they see it as a way to balance this unpredictability from China.
Again, I'm speaking with Perry Link, who is one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, politics, and people. He translated and edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and following the pro-reform student protests of June 1989. In 1996, the Chinese government blacklisted Perry Link. I suppose it gets back to the question: is it more likely that China will be a global superpower, flexing its muscles outward, if you will, or is it more likely that the China's leadership, as my understanding is that we ascribe great power and great projection to them that they're going to be the next hegemon. But my understanding is most Chinese leaders are looking over their shoulder at their own restive population, and these deep contradictions within the country between the people in the inland, the people on the coast, between the government that they're trying to build and the Communist Party mafia who still runs things. Aren't there some big internal contradictions?
Oh, absolutely. You're completely correct about that. The question of where China is going to be 20 years from now is not going to depend on geopolitics, in my view, nearly as much as on what happens inside China. With the rise of the Internet, for example, the power of public opinion is considerably stronger now than it was just 5 years ago. The controlled press that was successfully controlled in all its various media for decades in China, from radio to television to magazine to books, the Communist Party always had a way to control it and throttle it. They can't do that with the Internet. It's becoming ever more clear that they can't do that. And the Internet is becoming an alternate source of news, so that you can say that now in China there actually is a semi-free press, or how do I put that, a half of the press, the part that's on the Internet that ordinary netizens do, is completely free, and it's catching up, and it's forcing the official state media to be more credible, just because the Internet news is available, and people will all just believe the Internet if the regular media doesn't catch up with it. And this situation is getting beyond what the men at the top in Beijing can control, and they know it. And I think they're much more worried about that than they are about geopolitics.
And just turning to the economy and the extent to which China arguably the winners in globalization have been the Chinese peasants and Wall Street, and the extent to which people are being drawn from the rural areas into these new cities like the big Foxconn virtual city there out just near Hong Kong. I spoke to a journalist yesterday who's done some investigation into Apple's relationship with Foxconn and the extent to which indentured students are being used by provincial officials for cheap labor. All kinds of kickbacks flying around. But you just wonder how long China, as its economy grows, can in fact depend upon cheap labor, and also the extent to which people are being exploited within. That's bound to lead to the one thing that the communists really feared is a trade union, right? That's one of the great ironies.
Right. Yes, people call the Chinese economy a miracle, and it might be, in a sense, a miracle, but it's certainly not a mystery. It's the combination, as you say, of a huge supply of cheap labor over the last couple of decades, although that might be running out one of these days. And then capital. And these people work for low wages, long hours, with no union, no OSHA, no workers' compensation, no independent court to turn to if they need to, no environmental enforcements. And as I just said, until recently with the Internet, no free press. So they really are in a bottle, as this article you referred to me about Foxconn clearly shows. People are almost indentured servants in these large cities that are manufacturing goods for international and national and internal Chinese capital. It's odd here that there's such a confluence of interests on the side of capital between international corporations and Taiwan, which is the owner of this Foxconn operation, and the Communist Party of China. And one must add what you'd call local mafia. Mafia is the wrong word. That's from Italian roots, but local is underworld in China that takes care of the thuggery that keeps people in line. And the Communist Party and the thuggery and the international capitalists are all in concert here. Not that they always like each other and agree with each other, but in concert in making this great economic engine run. And how long it can run, is a difficult question because, as I said a moment ago, the supply of willing laborers, or in some cases only semi-willing laborers, is running thin. And then with the internet, the exposure of abuses is attracting more attention inside China than around the world. There is a lot of reporting in China on the social networks about this and that abuse, and almost reflexively, Chinese netizens, when they hear these reports, side with the ordinary people against the power elite. It's almost a reflexive reaction. So how stable this is a big question. And the fact that the top leaders know that it's not stable is clearly visible in the resources they've put into controlling events. The budget for what's called in Chinese Weiwen, maintaining stability, is now bigger than the military budget in China, the domestic stability control budget.
Well, just in closing, is there an analogy then between the leadership and particularly the generation of the so-called princelings and what's happening in Russia, where Putin, the ex-KGB man, seems to regulate the oligarchs? Is that what's happening there with the Communist Party top brass regulating these new billionaires?
In a very broad sense, I think it is, yes.
I see. Well, Perry Link, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Perry Link, who holds a Chancellor's Chair for Innovative Teaching Across Disciplines at the University of California, Riverside, where he's also a Professor of Comparative Literature and Foreign Languages. He is one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, politics, and people, and has translated many Chinese stories, writings, and poems into English. In the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform student protests of June 1989. In 1996, the Chinese government blacklisted Perry Link. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the father of non-violent... we'll take a brief station break and be back in a moment talking about the man who inspired much of the Arab Spring revolutions. Well, thanks again, Perry. So this will be up at ianmasters.com later tonight.
Okay, take care.
Thanks a lot. Great. Bye-bye. Hello.